Session number 6125, reel 1.
Mr. Hale, tape 1.
My name is Harry Sidney George Hale. I was born in Romford in Essex, England, on the 26th of May, 1915. My father was a journalist on a London newspaper, but he decided he wanted to join the forces to be with his friends. So he joined the RE Sigs before I was born and went overseas and never saw me until somewhere after my fourth birthday. My father had two brothers, Sid and Harry, after whom I'm named, Harry Sidney George. They were both in the forces, war service. My uncle Sid lost a lung, and my uncle Harry, he was a regimental sergeant major of the 4th Essex. He was killed on the 2nd and 3rd Battle of Gaza. He saw me before my father did, actually, just as he left to go overseas. My father's return from the war, we were living in Essex. I was living in Essex with my mother. He decided that we should go to the Isle of Wight to live where his mother and father were living, and he wished to go into some sort of business. He couldn't go back to journalism because they told him when he left to join the war that should he decide to join up, he wouldn't get his job back. But he did, and of course after the war he had to look around for a job. So they went to the Isle of Wight in a small village called Seaview, and my father got a job as Seaview pier master there, and they opened some tea rooms and restaurants, and at that time they were the only tea room round about there. They used to run day trips from Portsmouth to Seaview, and they used to call it the Sixpenny Sick. It only used to be sixpence for the journey from Portsmouth to Seaview, and shortly after the war, in the early 1920s, thousands used to come to the Isle of Wight on their day trips. Father and mother made money hand over fist by running tea rooms, which father did in addition to being pier master, and my mother and my grandmother ran the tea rooms, and money came in very thick and fast, sufficient for them to send me to a private school. I started school at the age of 4, went to a little primary school, and I started lessons, piano lessons, at the same age. At the age of 4, I started at my mother's knee. She was a brilliant pianist. And I started the little primary school at the age of 4, and then mother and father were sufficiently well off, or comfortably off, to send me to a private school and buy me a piano. But this only lasted a very short time because whereas for the first year, 18 months, they were the only tea room in Seaview. At the end of the second year, there were 14 tea rooms, and the third and fourth years moved up to 38 and 40, 50 tea rooms in and around the little village of Seaview, so cut everybody's throats, and nobody was able to make a living out of tea rooms. So mother and father decided that they'd build a laundry. So they built a laundry in the Isle of Wight. And they also were running another newsagents and tobacconists as well. And things weren't doing too well. But they built a laundry, and mother had some knowledge because her people were in the laundry business when she was a young girl up in Garrett Lane, Tooting. They father built this with the help of one or two men. They were large army Nissen huts. Started off very well, but mum and dad had no capital. They employed something like 14 and 20 girls in the first year, 18 months. Then it dwindled down till mother was just left ironing with one girl. They had to take me away from the school. Well, mum and dad were in business on and off for the rest of my time that I was at school, I suppose. I started at school on my fourth birthday and left on my 14th, and in the meantime I went to 8 different schools. The laundry business was sold as a going concern for £100, and my father went up to Essex. to work for my uncle. I think I was about 12 years old then. Then when all the recessions came in 1920, 21, the Labour government came in under, I think, Ramsay MacDonald, my uncle, in accordance with the then wishes of the Labour government, sold up his business and offered it to my father and my uncle's son. They decided they couldn't run the business between them. So father came back to the Isle of Wight. At that time, I was working in an office, and mum and dad went, as I say, back to the Isle of Wight and decided they'd like to open a business where I could learn a trade. So without consulting me in any way, they opened up a hairdresser's business. Not that I got any knowledge of hairdressing business, but they decided they'd rent a shop front, do board residence in the Isle of Wight, and open a hairdresser's business for me to learn a trade. Well, I was about 16 and a half or 17 then, so they took me out of my office to the Isle of Wight, put me in the hairdresser's business. It just wouldn't work. People were very conservative where they get their hair cut, and they just wouldn't give up their known hairdressers and all come to us. So we were the only hairdressers for 3 miles on either side of us. But time went on, and after about 2 years of this, my father couldn't get any work. Mother did board residence, and she did the people so well, they all wanted to come back. But this was because Mother fed them so well, and she made absolutely no profit on the deal at all. So sometimes in the shop we only used to take perhaps 3 shillings or 3 shillings and 6 pence for a whole week's work. We had to keep the hairdresser. His wages were £3.10 a week plus commission. We never got any commission, but we had to feed him. And then things got so bad that Dad had to close the shop down. He still had no work. And we had the bailiffs in. They sold us up because we got a bit behind with the rent. And an aunt of my father's saw all the posters plastered all around the little local town that the hairdressers would be sold up and distraint proceedings. She came in and cleared all the bills. We got rid of the bailiff who had to sit in and fed us. And we had to feed, rather. And Dad, of course, then had to close his shop, and we went to live with my grandmother back to our original Isle of Wight destination of Sea View. Grandmother lived in a little cottage. I slept on the floor in the front room, and I still, to a certain extent, kept up my music rather spasmodically. I did very well as a pianist as a boy. Was in the member of the church choir, started in the church choir at the age of 6. So music always played quite a big part in my life as a boy. And I still came in touch with my music teacher that my mother passed him on to when she felt that I needed more professional treatment than she was able to give me. And whilst I was out of work, or as I say, living on the on my grandmother in Sea View, mum and dad were out of work. Grandmother had nothing. Times were getting pretty hard. My father, an only child, who was always very, very strict with me and very jealous of the relationship between me and my mother, a relationship that, of course, really started in the 4 years that he never saw me between the time I was born and he came back from the war, wherein he was badly gassed. And he was the opinion I wouldn't have guts enough to join the forces. He wanted to know what I was going to do instead of laying about. So I went into our nearest town, which is Ryde, and I said I wished to join the Royal Army Medical Corps. I thought with my hairdressing experience, which I'd had over the 18 months, plus any nursing experience, I might be able to gauge. I might be able to work perhaps the two in some form of massage to work with my hairdresser when I'd finish serving in the forces. Besides which, there's quite a lot of nursing on my family, and I always fancied I'd like to have been a doctor, but mum and dad never had the money to put on my education to give me the chance of reading medicine in any manner of form. So, as I say, I went into Ryde to join up in the forces, and they sent me into Newport, which is the county town of the Isle of Wight, and I was just 18 years old then, and told the recruiting officer, or recruiting sergeant as he was, that I wished to join the forces. And I said, I want to join the Royal Army Medical Corps. There's no vacancies for the Medical Corps. He said, join the Dorset Regiment or the Hampshire Regiments or infantry regiments. But I said, no, I wanted a Medical Corps. Sorry, no vacancies. But he said, take the educational test and let's see if you can pass that. So we took the educational test, which seemed to be satisfactory. And he said, well, he said, I'll let you go home. He said, and I'll let you know, he said, as soon as any vacancies occur. And in the meantime, he said, think about joining the infantry regiment. Well, I thought I'd like to join the Royal Marine Band. So I made application to the military school, the Marine School of Music at Eastney Barracks, Portsmouth, and was asked to go over for an interview with the then Lieutenant Dunn. He subsequently became, I think, Colonel Vivian Dunn, Lieutenant Colonel Vivian Dunn of the Royal Marines. And I took over some music, I performed, and of course he asked me what other music, other instruments I could play, as he was quite well off for pianist. I said, well, a church organ. And he said, well, of course, he said, I couldn't possibly use a church organ in the Royal Marine Band. But he said, I think perhaps I could use you. He said, go home. He said, I need a harp. He said, go home and learn all you can, he said, about the harp. He said, read it up, he said, and I'll send for you as soon as there's a vacancy. Well, some week or two went by, and my father was getting a bit impatient to see me still hanging around, not in the Medical Corps, not in the infantry, and not in the Royal Marines. So he wrote to Lieutenant Dunn and asked him if, when he sent his son home to learn about the harp, did he mean for this war world or for the world to come? And Lieutenant Dunn promptly wrote back and said, sorry, he just couldn't use me, so he could only play just the one instrument. So my old music teacher, that I mentioned just earlier, he brought me in a brass band journal. He said, are you interested in this, Sid? I said, what's that? He said, well, a band of a famous Scottish regiment. He said, so a pianist, he said, for their band abroad, if you're interested. So I rode off to the bandmaster, the Royal Scots, at Aldershot, which was the address given. Still time went by, and I heard nothing. And then after waiting for about 4 more weeks, I had a letter come from the bandmaster, the Royal Scots, saying, was I still in the same mind of wish to join the a band of the Royal Scots. I regretted the delay in replying, but the battalion that was, when my letter was sent, were in the process of moving from Aldershot down to Dover, and all correspondence had delayed. But if I was still in the same frame of mind, would I let him know by return? I wrote back and said, well, I was waiting, see if I could be accepted for the Royal Army Medical Corps, but was quite prepared to take whichever came along first. I had a telegram, meet me at Portsmouth, signed Bandmaster Rhodes. So the next day I went to Portsmouth, saw Bandmaster Rhodes. I didn't have to perform for him, but I had to take across music. And he looked through the music and he said, well, he said that, have you any objection to going overseas for 6 or 7 years? I said, none whatsoever. He said, how long did I wish to join up for? I said, 21 years. He said, well, he didn't think I could join up for 21 years. But why was I so anxious? Well, I said, I was out of work. I was just going along the beach picking up coal and wood. And I had a father who didn't want me hanging around home, and I was anxious to get away from him. And he said, right, he'd make arrangements with the recruiting office in Newport to send for me. Well, a week went by and I had a telegram from Rhodes, you've not joined the battalion, why not? I sent back, said I haven't heard anything more since my interview with you. Next day, a telegram from a recruiting office in Newport, please come for your attestation, with a view to proceeding to Dover to join the Royal Scots. So I got one or two items of clothing and what have you together, and went into Newport, signed up, given a travel warrant all around the coast, and eventually ended up in the Citadel Barracks in Dover. I was met by a band corporal who asked me what I played. I said, "Oh, piano." He said, "Another bloody pianist." He said, "We're full up with pianists." He said, "What degrees, diplomas have you got?" I said, "Sorry, I haven't got any." He said, "What standard did you reach?" I told him, "High local in a Trinity College." But I said, "I understood I was for the band abroad." "Oh," he said, "that's all right." And he said, "You play dance music?" I said, "No." "What experience you had in the orchestra?" "Oh, only light chamber music." So I was then taken over to the army barrack room. Most awful feeling, opening the barrack room doors. So there were large barrack rooms. There must have been about 30 men all sitting on their beds. Most of them seemed to have boots in their hands, which they were seemed to be rubbing, and some had had some instruments on the bed. One or two were blowing in them. And that was my entry into the Band of the Royal Scots. The chap whose bed I ended up on while the corporal went away with somebody else to get me a bed, he asked me if I like a drop of tea. I said yes. He said, "Do you take sugar?" I said no. He said, "Well, that's right, you don't get any sugar in the army anyway." So a mug eventually drifted up in our direction, an old enamel mug, all stained terribly, and he passed it over to me. "God, so I drink out of this blooming thing." And I taste it. It was as sweet as anything, because I wasn't used to having sugar at all. And I downed it, and of course that was my first experience of any eating or drinking in the army. And I joined in April 34, April 34, did my training in Dover. I never went to Scotland, and met up with some other recruits who joined the band directly. The chaps who were recruited directly in the band came straight to the battalion, whereas if I'd gone into the unit, apart from being in the band, I would have gone to Penny Cook in Edinburgh, just outside Edinburgh, and done my depot training up there. But I did all the training in Dover, and on December the 13th, which was a Friday, I left Southampton on the Troopship Lancashire. I think it was the Lancashire. It wasn't the Dunera or Dilwara. Troopship Lancashire for Karachi. And we had a terrible sea. I was terribly sick and homesick. And in the fullness of time, we did arrive at Karachi, but I swore that I'd never have a trouble like that again if I had freedom of choice. I realised that the officers and the nursing system and what have you that we were taking all were much better looked after than we were on the lower deck. We were just, well, the officer, the stench was so bad with sick and vomit generally and excreta that was floating down from the heads that the officer of the day just, well, I think perhaps they were too ill to even come, because we had the troop deck captain said it was the worst sea they'd had for 27 years in the Bay of Biscay. Everybody was sick. We had married quarters. The women just didn't care a button for their children, because they were all so sick themselves. I was fortunate in as much as I was the orderly room, or CO's orderly, I forget which, and I had the run of the ship. Although the ship's company, apart from those who were actually concerned in running the ship, and all the troops that we were carrying were all battened down below, and they had military police were armed and were actually battened just behind where the bands were put on the gangway so that nobody could get up or down, except for just myself and the other chap who was also doing the orderly room or CO's orderly. And right throughout the bad sea, although I used to be sick, I did manage to get a bit of fresh air and was that much better off than a lot of others. But we did eventually reach Karachi after passing through. We did a bit of oiling in the Mediterranean, Port Said, Port Suez. I came down through on the bridge of the Lancashire as we came right down through the Suez. It was most, really a most wonderful sight coming down through there. It was as calm as anything. But we hit the Red Sea, and because it was very, very hot. We had no air conditioning in those days as such. And it just used to be the wind scoops up top, and the conditions were pretty bad. Trooping, of course, as everyone knows, was just confined to the cooler weather. It wasn't done during certain times of the year owing to the heat and the lack of any sort of forms of air conditioning. But we reached Karachi, then we boarded a troop train, and I went up to Lahore. And that was where I stayed, apart from movements up to the hill stations of Kasauli, Simla. I went to Simla, did quite a lot of band work. I discovered that there was no future pound shillings and pence wise in not learning to play dance music, because the dance band was ever on call. There was plenty of engagements, and if you played in any of the bands, dance band, orchestra or military band, you got paid for it over and above your 2 shillings a day, which was your army rate of pay then. But you could pick up quite a bit of money playing for dance music. And we became resident orchestra and dance band for one of the very big hotels called Stifel's in Lahore. And I joined Lahore Cathedral Choir and got my music going there. I played for all sorts of dancers all round the northern part of England, India. Went up to Kashmir, to Quetta, saw the tail end of that very big earthquake, the 1933 earthquake in Quetta, which hundreds of thousands of people lost their lives. Kashmir was really beautiful. I went up there for a holiday, went up to Simla, played for the Viceroy up there in the dance band. I was then the senior pianist in the band because the chap who was a pianist before me, he was a better pianist, in as much as he had a lot of experience, a very, very good dance pianist. He got an audition for the Viceroy's band as pianist and trumpeter, and he was accepted, and he left. And of course, although there were two or three other pianists, apart from myself, I did get the chance of the better jobs, and I got my first stripe then. Promotion was very, very slow in the band because they had an establishment of say 30 or 40 people, and it was a case of dead man's shoes. They could only keep a complement of NCOs of so many, and you'd get a direct replacement from the UK in those days if you were short of a pianist, short of an oboe player or any other form of instrument. You'd apply to the home battalion, and it was their job to feed your battalion here direct with a pianist, a similar manner to which I was accepted and came abroad. So the establishment remained very much the same of NCOs, and when the sergeant died, well, the next full corporal would move up, and he'd become a lance sergeant, and or when they came home. You never served for less than about 6.5, usually 7 years. You'd signed on for 7 with the colours and 5 with the reserve, giving you 12 years. But when you went abroad, you knew that although your time with the colours would be up, the chances are that you'd be running into your reserve time before you came home. So you had to make up your mind that once you were out there, because the chances of buying a discharge was very, very remote in those days. It would cost the earth, and as I say, you're only on 2 shillings a day, and unless your folks at home could provide you with the money, where you were, you stuck. We had bags of sport there. I became very good at hockey. Although I was quite a footballer before I joined the army, first game in the army, I was right out of my class, and I was so disgusted with my play that I don't think I ever put football boots on again. I took up boxing. I was quite a good boxer. I was able to hold my weight in the battalion as a welterweight until somewhat later in India, in China, the bandmaster said enough. We were getting too many cuts and bruises, so all boxing with where the band was concerned was stopped. But we had quite a bit of riots to deal with whilst during my stay in India. We were brought from the hills on one occasion down into Lahore, where the temperature was 127, I think, in the shade. We were marched down very quickly from a place called Dagshai down to the plains where we had been 10,000 feet up in Dagshai, and marched us down to the plains, and we were downhill all the way with full pack and rifle. When we got to the bottom, two collapsed and died. They'd marched us down with no short route marches during the period up the top, and of course coming down, the fact that you were coming downhill with all the weight of the full pack rifle and ammunition on you, we came down at such a lick, we came down even faster than the record that up till then had been held by the Gurkhas. We came down into the plains, and when they managed to get us on the train, because once we stopped, it was real difficult to start again. We got on the plane, and we trained, and we went direct from Kalka to Lahore, where we detrained. They give us a meal in the heat of 120-odd, the shade of stewed steak. And then we went down to the riots in Lahore. Oh, quite a number of incidents took place, which is without outside the terms of reference, I take it of this. After doing about 3.5 years, I suppose, in Lahore, we learned that the battalion was moving to Hong Kong. And
what year was that?
Be about 37...